Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Joined now by one of Ireland's most celebrated and original young writers. She's being accused of being one of the voices of her generation. Her debut novel, Exciting Times, was a sensation, and her new book, The Happy Couple, is just out. And it's about an Irish wedding, but not your typical Irish wedding, I guess. But then again, she's not your typical Irish writer. Nisha Dolan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Brendan, in person at last.
Yes, and we spoke remotely, of course, when Exciting Times came out. And I think it was that grim pandemic time, wasn't it?
Yeah, God, dark times.
Yes, but you're living in Berlin right now. I gather you're loving being at home, doing all the press and everything, yes?
Yeah, Berlin suits me, but there's something special about coming back and talking to Irish people who are maybe a bit more friendly than Germans. I don't think that's too controversial to say.
I don't know. Can you say that anymore about the Germans?
Well, the Germans say about the Germans, so I feel like we're allowed to say too.
Okay. So congratulations on the new book, The Happy Couple. And as I was saying, it revolves around an Irish wedding, but it's a bit more complicated than that. Would you explain? I don't want to ask you, like, tell the people what your book is about, Nisha, but would you explain it maybe a bit?
I'll do my best. I think all of the characters are a bit confused, so it might take time to lay out their confusion. But we've got Luke and Celine, who at the start of the novel decide to get married. And then we've got Celine's sister and two of Luke's exes, who between them give their perspective in the run-up to the wedding, and that's the event that it's all hinging on ultimately, should these people get married and how they go about it.
And it feels a bit like a clash of cultures, because you have this very traditional setting, this mechanism of a wedding, and it's being thrown by like a kind of an Irish aunt and uncle in London who've done well, I think, in the building kind of. But then you have this generation of young people involved, and your cast of characters are probably more kind of diverse and open, and would we say fluid in their sexuality and everything, than you might find in a normal Irish book about a wedding. Yeah?
Yeah, I think so. And I really wanted to commit to having that be almost the setting. I think if you've got some characters like that and you pit them against a more traditional point of view, then identity almost becomes the conflict, whereas I wanted identity to be a given and for it to go without saying that this gay friend group can be the heroes of a story, and that readers who mightn't be from such a community themselves can empathise with it. Because we take the other kind of empathy for granted. We take it for granted that gay people are able to empathise with straight literature. So I like for it to go the other way sometimes, and for that to just be the setting.
Okay, so if I get this right, so you're not making a big deal out of the fact that they're all variously bisexual, gay, whatever, they just happen to be.
Yes.
And it's not gay fiction.
Well, it is in that it's who the characters are, but yeah, who they are isn't at issue in the text. There's no internal conflict over it. Much like if an Irish character isn't tortured about the fact that they're Irish and no one's trying to get them to pretend not to be Irish. They're just Irish, and it doesn't mean that that doesn't have an impact on who they are. They're probably different to if they'd had the misfortune of being born in England, but it's Irish literature without being literature where Irishness is the conflict.
Gotcha. So you've now offended the Germans and the English.
I'm on a roll. Who can I do next?
Yeah, okay. Just don't do the Irish and you'll be fine. Let's face it, people don't mind in this country who you offend as long as it's not us. So listen, I know it's that these particular characters, this is their milieu and this is the way they are and everything, but I think it will feel for a lot of older people, which I might reluctantly say that I am now part of that, the world of dating, relationships, all that, it probably has changed a lot for the younger generation, has it?
I think definitely the digital platforms have given it a certain transience that maybe it didn't once have. I think when people were mostly dating people they at least vaguely knew through their friend circle, there was more of a requirement to behave in a way that you wouldn't later get sanctioned for, whereas now there's a disposability to it, I think. And that's not just at the level of casual dating and people ghosting each other. I think it bleeds into how we treat even people we stay with for a long time. There's, I don't want to say a selfishness, but I think an awareness that you don't have to do things the traditional way, but without a clear other way of doing things that makes people maybe a bit lost.
Okay, so that the people are fundamentally, primarily, they're alone in all these interactions and they're sole traders, if you will.
I think the way that explains it for these particular characters anyway is that they've grown up in a time where they can no longer really believe in the traditional ways that we structure our lives, but nor do they have a clear other thing to commit to. And it's hard to just invent ways of being for yourself. So I think that's why they make abundant mistakes that then thankfully drive enough conflict for a novel.
Okay, now I don't want to over-dramatise this, but it does sound like you could be saying that that generation, we're talking kind of mid-20s and stuff, are they a bit lost? So without the kind of structures that we all, that the likes of me grew up with in the past?
They definitely are. But on the other hand, there's a level in which that's always been true of being young. You're always pushing against what came before.
Yeah. And I think what we came to realise sometimes as we got a bit older was that we threw out the baby with the bathwater. So we rejected religion. And then we suddenly discovered there's no meaning in our lives. Then we headed to the Eastern mysticism section in Waterstones to find it or whatever. But yeah, it's an interesting cycle that goes on. So you would identify now as queer.
Yes.
Which obviously, I think listeners will be unsure, maybe even feeling a frisson of nerves when I use that word to you, because obviously it's a very loaded word in lots of ways, and it's a word that some people who are gay would object to being used in everything. What does it mean to you?
Well, I think the frisson of nerves is in there, in it. It means that I'm sexually attracted to people besides men. And I think for me, what's bound up in it too is not wanting to have too much of a fixed public persona around identity questions that I regard as fluid, because I want to be able to do whatever feels right in the moment as me without thinking about how do people see me. So I like its embrace of ambiguity, even if that same ambiguity can be a bit nerve-wracking sometimes.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, and I'm not trying to force any labels on either, because it must be difficult to have to choose a label, given we're all different, we're all on various spectrums. Like, I was reading that you kind of had to call yourself bi for a while. You became a bit trapped in being bi for a while then, yeah?
Yeah, and it's a tricky one, because I have also found that labels have brought a lot of people to my work who really appreciated it. I've had readers come up to me nearly crying, telling me how much it meant to them, for example, to have an openly autistic writer, and they mightn't have come to my work without having that label attached. But at the same time, I never want to feel boxed in by the perceptions of people outside a given community with that label. So it's a tough one, and I'm not sure there's an objectively right answer. So yeah. I guess what I try to do is describe myself as best I can, but bring nuance to it as well.
So queer is a kind of the broadest term you can bring to it. And how was your own road to finding yourself and finding your tribe and everything? Is it easier these days than it might have been 10, 20, 30 years ago?
I think so, but it's hard to say how much of that is that society has changed and how much is just that I've grown up a lot and I'm a lot more comfortable in myself. I think a lot of queer people go through a journey where the things that they haven't accepted in themselves, they can't really accept in others yet. And so nowadays, because I unambiguously accept myself, it's much easier to find my people and be comfortable around them. Whereas maybe that community was there a long time before I realised, but I wasn't looking for it or as welcoming to it. So hard to disentangle from social trends, but I'm happier now, definitely.
And was your journey to self-acceptance difficult?
Yes, but I guess the difficulty is what makes it finally so rewarding. And that's not to say we should go through bad things for the sake of growth. Obviously not, that would be pointless, but I don't truly regret anything that's happened to me in life, because it's what was necessary to get me to where I am now. That sounds canned, but I think it's true.
Yeah. And did bad things happen on your road? Yeah.
Yeah, plenty of bad things, but good things too.
Okay. Did you have a difficult time in school?
Yes, but again, I'm not sure how much of that was external and how much of it was internal. I think if your head is a furnace, then it's kind of hard to feel relaxed in your environment.
Yeah. And is it more complicated then because I guess this is a classic intersectionality here, that you do you have autism or are you autistic? Do you have it or are you it?
I am it.
It is me. Okay, it is you.
Okay. I am the spectrum in person.
Okay, I see. So it's not something that's an add-on to your personality. It is through you, right through you.
Yes, which is why I find it impossible to describe how it affects me as such, because there's nothing in me that I would see as outside it.
Yeah. And so you have queerness there and autism. I'm not treating you like a lab rat, no, but this is right. Interesting. You have queerness there and you have autism, both kind of huge parts of your identity, yeah?
Yes.
So difficult to unpick what's what and everything and all of that, is it?
Yeah, and I'm an Aries while we're at it.
Oh my God, okay. The full package.
This is it.
So you discovered the autism finally, I think, just before Exciting Times came out. Had you suspected it?
Yeah, for a long time. It had been flagged when I was a teenager, but it wasn't formally assessed at the time. So I think I just chose not to deal with it back then. I think sometimes you've got to come to things when you're ready, even if that might take a lot longer than if you'd been forced to confront them. But I'm glad I did come to it on my own terms, because it's really easy to go down the wrong way with that stuff. And
what do you mean?
So, for instance, if I'd been diagnosed as a child, I'm not positive that my life would have been better, because my parents, well-meaning people who aren't medical experts, might have, for example, sent me to therapy where I would have been punished for showing autistic behaviours. And I still ended up doing that myself. But
they might have tried to fix you?
Yes, quite possibly. And this still exists. It's called ABA and it's pretty roundly condemned by the adult autistic community, but still pretty common. So I think I was potentially spared a lot of that by no one knowing. I think I got away with a bunch of stuff that would have been snuffed out, and then I wouldn't be such a good writer. I mean, maybe I'm not good, but I wouldn't be as good a writer as I am, whatever level that is.
Okay, so politically, the view of some people with autism would be that the attempts to, quotes, help them by helping them to maybe behave in a more functional fashion, if we can call it that, in the broader world, that is actually eradicating their identity and forcing them to be something they're not, correct?
Yes, and it's not something that any caring person would truly want for them. So, for instance, I taught myself how to superficially feign smiling and seeming relaxed, but that's not actually having the effect that people who care about me would want, which is for me to actually be happy and relaxed. And in obsessing over how to make my face look relaxed, I was paradoxically making myself all the tenser and less happy. So I don't think it's in the best interests of autistic people to teach them to make themselves seem acceptable. And I think that goes for people in general. It's a universal human experience, I think, that we have to hide bits of ourselves that we'd rather just have out.
Yeah. So that's what we talk about masking, is it?
Yes.
And we're told that the reason that there weren't as many girls diagnosed with autism until maybe more recently is because girls were much better at masking. And we mentioned people pleasing earlier, and people pleasing and being what they should be.
Yes.
Was that what you did?
Yeah. And I wouldn't even say better at in the sense of naturally better at. I think there's just more pressure. So it's not that women start with a higher ability to be pleasing to others. It's that they're more heavily punished for not.
Okay. So that must be a huge strain. Did you do that for a long time?
Yes, I would say I only really started undoing it in the last couple of years. And I think actually my life is a very interesting example to me, at least. I mean, everyone's interested in their life, but an example of how society is what disables people. Because largely the way that I act is exactly the way I acted when I was six. It's just now I'm rewarded for it. I'm rewarded for being annoying. And if I think a question is silly, unpicking the premises of the question instead of just answering it. I'm rewarded for wanting to read and write all day instead of doing whatever is viewed as normal. I'm rewarded for hyper-focusing on something and getting a book out of it instead of being a little bit good at everything. So really, I haven't changed at all. I've just found a thing that works for me.
Wow. So go back to the question then about you having to pretend all that time. Was it all the time? Were you doing this all day?
Yes, I think so. it got probably worse in my teens and in my 20s because I was having to spend more and more time around other people.
Okay. And so that must wear you out massively, does it?
Yes. And I think the worst thing was when you're doing it around other people, you can't then stop doing it on your own. So,
oh, God.
Yeah, I just completely lost touch with myself. I think it was maybe 6 months ago that I realised I think this and I feel this aren't just different ways of phrasing the same thing. That when you say you feel something, you're referring to something is happening in some part of your body besides the front of your brain. No idea, because I'd been using the front of my brain to do absolutely everything for decades.
Okay, so you were living in your head completely.
Yeah.
Were you pretending with your own family and the people who loved you as well, yeah?
Yeah, and with myself, because what wasn't... It wasn't that at an early age I had decided I am going to pretend to be different. It was that I felt that the way I naturally was so obviously evil and wrong that I would be a bad person if I didn't start pretending otherwise. And I found the idea of being a bad person so unbearable that I was lying even to myself.
So did you decide in your own head that what you were was evil or wrong, or was it something that you were subtly being taught by the system around your school and etc.?
I decided, but I don't feel like kids decide that kind of thing about themselves for a laugh, so I must have got it from somewhere. I think I was always a very sensitive person and maybe a little bit too perceptive in some ways, and it probably wasn't any one influence. It was probably the general impression that everything that's said about women, that you can't be too loud or too assertive or too different, then gets magnified if being autistic naturally makes you more of all those things. And some cocktail occurred, and at some point I decided that my real self was unacceptable even to me.
Okay. So tell me then about, was it after you got the diagnosis that you kind of felt free to come home to yourself and start to let your authentic self out?
Eventually. It was definitely a process and not a linear one. And I think last year when I moved to Berlin and stopped doing so much book publicity was a really important step in that, because if you're trying to process something where you realise you've been lying to yourself and everyone for decades while having a public face, it's quite difficult to balance those things. So I think taking the time out and working out what I'm like when there's not so much pressure was really vital in that.
Okay. It must be a profoundly kind of emotional experience to realise that for all those years you were having to do that and that you can suddenly now breathe.
Yeah. And I think at the same time I'm conscious of, to use a phrase you invoked earlier, not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because it's not that those years were meaningless. It's not that things didn't happen that weren't profound and valuable. It's just that I have to reckon with the fact that I was doing all of it with a hand tied behind my back. And untying a hand behind your back is much simpler than unpicking all that neural wiring. And so I can't really say when I'll be done, when I'll really feel that I'm being myself. Maybe never.
Yeah.
Maybe no one's ever really themselves.
No, but you see, this is it. Like, and do we even know when we're being completely authentic?
Yeah.
Like, are you being fairly authentic now, do you think? Or is there one little kind of filter going on still that's conscious of what you're saying and doing?
I think I'm being authentic.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe a year from now, I'll discover something about myself. And I'll be like, God,
know,
who is she?
I know, this is it. Oh my God, you're blowing my mind now as well. Yeah.
But it's so universal is the thing. And that's why, while I think labels are a useful way of understanding ourselves, they can also be a limit in some ways. So
I don't
want anyone to listen to this and go, oh, I'm relating to this, but I'm not autistic, so I'm not allowed to. Because obviously, it's not only is the autism spectrum a spectrum, but being a person is a spectrum.
Yes, absolutely. So then, how was it helpful to say to yourself, or for someone to say to you, okay, you're autistic?
Very much so in terms of getting rid of the guilt. I think that was probably the biggest block on understanding myself, the feeling that I had done something profoundly wrong in being naturally the way that I was. And so having that initial awareness that the guilt didn't necessarily come from something bad inside me, I think that let me be open-minded. I think guilt is so unhelpful for really understanding things. We need to have a more neutral, curious attitude before we can really get to the bottom.
Yeah. When you say guilt, shame, it sounds like even maybe a bit stronger than guilt, was it?
Yes, yeah. Profound shame, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very painful as well, isn't it? For a kid, like, you think of you as a young kid, like.
Yeah, but yeah. At the same time, it's quite a ubiquitous Irish thing, I think.
You see, this is it again. It's all spectrums, isn't it?
But I think nobody in this country is a stranger to some form of shame.
No shame-free people around here. So then, and I know you said to me earlier, it's very hard for you to say how the autism, I mean, how it affects you sounds weird because it sounds like some kind of illness you have, like, which obviously it's how do you view it as an aspect of who you are, a part of who you are?
I think so. I can't think of anything that isn't sometimes annoying to deal with that doesn't also have a positive impact elsewhere in life. So, for example, I'm not the best answerer of emails or rememberer of minor appointments or things. But that's because I have a steely focus on the things that I really want. And if I had a low-level minor focus on everything, I would have to sacrifice the steely focus. And so you just have to take the good with the bad, I think.
Yeah. I've seen that you talk about eye contact is hard for you. No, your eye contact seems excellent at the moment.
Cheers. 10 out of 10.
Yeah, there you go. You're obviously, the unmasking habits aren't gone yet, fully. But what I'm interested in there is that we associate eye contact with trust, connection, these things. And that, like, people say, oh, you wouldn't meet my eye. They're suspicious of that person. Do you think that's something that was affecting your relations with people?
Yeah, although this is an interesting one because I think kids are often way smarter about adults than adults are. Some people do just have something that makes you not want to look at them. And we often discourage kids from following their instincts on that stuff, not necessarily just with eye contact, but with making them hug a relative they don't want to hug. And it might be that there's no actual reason not to want to hug the relative. But I think far more important than preserving that relative's feelings in the moment should be teaching the kid that they should trust their instincts on people, because there's a reason we have those instincts and they're not always literally accurate. But we can't make cognitive decisions on everything or we die from the effort of it.
Yeah, yeah. Trust the gut sometimes. I'm really conscious now of my eye contact as well. Are you really conscious of your eye contact as well?
Well, this is the thing. If you make anyone conscious of it, it's like blinking. Like, suddenly you can't do it naturally.
Yeah, shouldn't have brought it up. We like to think now that as a society, we're less ableist and more open and more inclusive and all that kind of thing. Do you think we are?
It's really hard to say because I've come a long way in terms of my ability to advocate for myself and describe my experiences, but I probably would have even if society hadn't changed, just from being older. So I don't know what it's like for people with as little power as I used to have or with less power than I've ever had. And I think there's a problem sometimes where we cherry pick a few people who've been successful and are therefore viewed as useful to society, and we go, aren't we great, we've lifted this one person up, when their experience mightn't be too reflective of the community as a whole. So
interesting one. And people, I know that people are going to text in now and say, that's fantastic about Nisha and she's doing so well and everything. But why don't you talk more about people, autistic people like my son, who is nonverbal and who is 24 hours a day, I'm having to work hard to. And like, I sometimes wonder if the spectrum is so broad as to maybe not have a useful meaning because you're here and you're autistic and then there's people having very different experiences as well.
I think it depends on what people are looking to get out of the clinical terms. And there's a scarcity mindset with this as well, where because it's so difficult in this country to have a disabled child, we misassign the blame sometimes, and instead of blaming the government for not having broad-ranging support for everyone and all their needs, we look at people that we imagine are stealing what support there is, which, by the way, isn't true. I don't know any autistic adult who has ever gotten money simply for being autistic. But, like, I wish. Yeah. Then I wouldn't have to write these books. I could just sit back and let my brain earn me money. But no, it doesn't happen. No one's taking anything. But I think as well, the answer isn't to preclude people from describing themselves in ways that make sense. I think it's just to broaden the narrative and ask other people to describe their experiences too and bring more voices in, not less.
Yeah. It does create that issue, though, that you're saying about that the rest of society can make itself feel good by going, sure, look at her now, isn't she great? She's writing the books and everything and she has the old autism. Like, there's a touch of that, isn't there?
Yeah, I truly support the right of autistic people to be mediocre and to do no better than their fellow man and to still have rights.
Yes, yes. Okay, so they don't all have to be as useful as you.
No. Yeah. I mean, I don't think a novelist is necessarily the most useful person of all time, but, you know.
You're passionate about climate change. We don't have time to get all into it now, but do you think we'll actually save ourselves?
Oh, God. Two answers. Okay. Based on the data and the patterns that I've identified, no. But based on what I tell myself day to day as I'm making my decisions, yes. Because I think what story you tell yourself about something, it makes a much more powerful difference than trying to take everything in and crunch some kind of numbers on it. And it's not that I lie to myself, but I look for things that are true that I'm going to choose to emphasize. So, for instance, I subscribe to a newsletter in Der Spiegel, the German newspaper, with a title that translates as All Good, and it only gives you good news. And the point is, it's still news. They're not making things up,
okay,
but they focus on the positives. And we can only take in so much information at a time. So we might as well take in information that we think will make us act in an effective and life-enhancing way instead of information that will make us despair all the time.
Okay. And you're saying novelists aren't useful? That was a very useful thing to tell people. I think people take away nothing else from this. There was a good idea there. I hesitate to name drop, but Greta Thunberg did tell me that there are a lot of autistic people in the climate activist community. It's obviously... Is it that autistic people are seeing it more clearly or something?
Yes. And I think this is another example of how there's no thing that's straightforwardly an impediment or an asset. Because when I was a kid, if my mum asked me if an item of clothing suited her, I would give the honest answer, whether or not that answer was what she wanted to hear. But it also means it's a lot easier to see through lies and to look at what's actually going on. And I think that's why so many of, especially these kids at the forefront of Fridays for Future, they're examining the same information that we all have. It's just they don't have the ability to put this layer over it so that they can get on with their lives. And that's what really drives change.
Yeah. Fascinating. Okay, so listen, just to remind people, Naoise Dolan, you are a novelist and your new book, The Happy Couple, is out now. It's published by WNN and it is excellent. And I believe, exciting times, your first novel is being made into an Amazon TV show.
Well, I can't talk about that right now because I, like all decent US-based writers, I'm on strike. But
oh, yes. Okay. Naoise Dolan, excellent eye contact. Thank you very much. Good to meet you.
Cheers, Brendan.
Email brendan@rte.ie.